Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for tonight's address by the Secretary of the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, Dr. Martin Parkinson. Ladies and gentlemen, I see some familiar faces, and some of you were here last week when the Treasurer, Scott Morrison, addressed the Institute arguing for the importance of trade, investment and immigration to Australia's economic future. I was just saying to Martin that that speech was in an interesting contrast to a speech by the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, in the UK a couple of days ago, which was much more hard line on migration. And I thought it was very positive, as I said last Friday, to hear the Treasurer make such a full-blooded argument for the importance of those three elements of international engagement to our future. Both of these speeches by the Treasurer and the Secretary come at a transitional moment for the Institute's work on international economic policy. After 4 years, our G20 Study Centre program has brought its work to a close. And in fact, this is the Centre's last official event. And hosting speeches by the Treasurer and the head of the Australian Public Service is a fitting way to mark the work done by our scholars over the past 4 years. We established the Centre with the support of the Australian Government because international economic governance matters to Australia. Membership of the G20 enables us to further our national interests by contributing to global welfare. We can play a significant role in contributing to the design of the rules of the international economic game and advocating an open, transparent, rules-based international economic order that safeguards our economy. This is the kind of work that the Lowy Institute was established for, to create a national conversation about these issues and to produce high-quality, balanced and independent analysis. The output of the Centre has been prodigious. Its experts, including Leon Berkelmans, Hannah Werf and Tris Sainsbury, as well as Steve Grenville, our long-serving non-resident fellow on the international economy, have been quoted in the New York Times, The Journal, The FT, The Economist, Bloomberg, Reuters, BBC, as well as in all the major Australian outlets. Experts from the Centre have published 130 posts on our digital magazine, The Interpreter, dozens of major op-eds, 24 G20 monitors, 8 analysis papers, and 1 book. So it's been a hugely successful exercise from our point of view. We're very proud of the work that the Centre did over the 4 years. I'm pleased to say the Institute won't be quitting the field of international economic governance, however. There are not many sources of international macroeconomic analysis outside of Canberra, and we plan to stay in the game. Global economic risks loom, not least that of a Trump presidency. And if the Lowy Institute is to continue informing the Australian debate about the world and influencing our international policy, then international economics must continue to be a central theme of the Institute's work. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Martin Parkinson holds doctoral and master's degrees from Princeton University, a master's in economics from the ANU, and a Bachelor of Economics from the University of Adelaide. Martin joined the Treasury in 1981. Since then, he's worked at the Fund on Global Financial Architecture Reform. He was a DepSec at Treasury. He was the inaugural Secretary of the Department of Climate Change, as well as Secretary of the Treasury. And he was appointed the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and the head of the Australian Public Service on the 23rd of January 2016. Martin is among our sharpest economic minds, and having headed 3 major departments of state in Canberra, he is also one of our most important voices in Australia's public policy debates. Martin, we are very proud indeed that you agreed to join us and to give the final speech to the G20 Study Centre, and this your first speech to the Institute as Secretary of PM&C. Martin Parkinson.
Thanks, Michael. It's a huge pleasure to be here today and to see a number of old friends, or should say, I say long-standing friends rather than old, Steve. Let me begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today, and allow me to pay my respects to their elders past and present, and allow me also to extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples here today. The Lowy Institute has a unique place in Australian policy firmament, and all of us who are here, policymakers, commentators, members of the public, benefit from the excellent work that the Institute has done. not just in the area of the G20 Study Centre, but just more broadly across the work that the Institute has done since it was established. The focus of my remarks today is going to be on the implications of changing attitudes towards globalisation, both in terms of domestic policy choices and also the role of multilateral fora like the G20. Because of time constraints, I'm going to give you effectively an abridged version of a speech that will go up on the PM&C website, which will go into much greater detail on a range of the things that I'm going to talk about. But the experience of the three decades... Sorry, just looking for some water, thanks. The experience of the three decades preceding the global financial crisis was that countries that embraced trade, open trade and investment policies experienced significant gains in income, employment and national living standards. Globally, those policies reduced the number of people in extreme poverty from 1.9 billion in 1990 to about 836 million in 2015. So if you think about it, we took a billion people out of abject poverty in a 25-year period. And not only did we take those people out of abject poverty, but we lifted so many other people who were at the bottom end of the global income distribution. However, growing concern about the distribution of those gains, particularly in the context of weaker overall economic growth post the GFC, has led to an escalation of protectionist sentiment, both here and abroad. And now that's an issue that was actually front and centre at the G20 leaders' discussions in Guangzhou only a couple of weeks ago. Now, the pressures on governments to retreat from open trade and investment policies are not new. And that's why, as Michael said, it was so great to see the Treasurer actually out there putting a stake in the ground about the importance of these. But they're not new, either here or abroad. But if you think about the Australian context, if we cast our mind back to the late 19th century, heated exchanges between Victoria's protectionists and New South Wales's free traders were at the centre of the debate about the terms under which the six colonies would federate. It took around two decades to resolve that debate, but ultimately was determined in favour of free trade. So when Australia was born as a federated nation, at the beginning of the 20th century, we were newly forged as a nation, but we were newly forged as a global nation. We had a global perspective in our policy settings. But shortly after the trauma of the First World War, we changed tack on both industry and trade policy. From the 1920s, we set about becoming a highly protected economy, sheltering our manufacturing industries from international competition. And our protectionist period really started in earnest in 1921 with the creation of the Tariff Board, which was itself motivated by infant industry arguments. This was the idea that somehow we needed to diversify our economy beyond broadacre crops and minerals into large-scale manufacturing, and yet Australian industry had not yet developed to the point where it'd be able to compete on the global marketplace. What the champions of protectionism at that time failed to acknowledge, as they do today, was that the difficulty of removing industry support once it's been provided, the political economy of trying to unpick support once it's been given, and the impact of protectionism on other parts of the economy. This included the increased costs that Australia's high tariff wall imposed on consumers, the downstream producers who were competing internationally, and those domestic businesses that were vying with those protected industries for what was scarce labour and capital. Gary Banks has said, and I quote, "The economic costs of this regime were masked by the performance of our broadacre agricultural and mining industries." Think about what happened post-World War II, Korea, wool boom. We've got, you know, everything's going well, and it looks like our policies are actually working. When in actual fact, it was really the demand for those commodities that led to the boost, the temporary boost in our terms of trade and our national income. So effectively, we were riding on the sheep's back, and as Gary has stated, I'll quote again, we were riding for a fall. During the 1970s, the prices we received for our commodity exports commenced a long decline, while the costs of our imports began to rise. The resulting terms of trade deterioration would in turn expose the underlying problems of Australia's poor productivity performance. So over time, the related reduction in our international competitiveness had placed us in a really quite precarious economic position. We were actually undermining our national economic prosperity in a structural sense, but it was being masked by a series of cyclical phenomena that allowed people to believe that the policies that were being pursued were actually worthwhile. As I discussed in my essay last year, The Lucky Country Has It Run Out of Luck, by the early to mid-80s, after a decade bookended by recessions and characterised by stubbornly high unemployment, stagnant growth, persistent inflation and declining relative living standards, Australians knew that we had to change. In 1980, then Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew sharpened this recognition when he directly challenged our national pride and our sense of self by asserting that Australians were on the way to being the poor white trash of Asia. This was followed by the warning from then Treasurer Paul Keating in 1986 that without change, we would become, quote, a third-rate country, a banana republic, unquote. And change we did. Beginning in the early 80s, we embarked on one of the most significant reform programs ever seen in any advanced economy. We floated the currency, deregulated the financial system, reframed macroeconomic policy, and opened up product and labour markets by sweeping away ossifying rules and regulations designed to create a cosy life for business and unions at the expense of consumers. The agility of our economy increased markedly through reforms to our financial, labour and product markets. We were open for trade, we were open for business, and what happened? Job opportunities flourished as a result. Rising living standards and expanding range of opportunities have seen the vast majority of Australians benefit from this era of outward-focused economic reform, and we continue to enjoy the gains from that today. Now, we were not the only country to have benefited from outward-looking trade and investment policies. When we look overseas, globalisation's been responsible for dramatic reductions in global poverty, as I just said. Within a lifetime, countries like China and the original Asian tigers, South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan and Hong Kong, have witnessed an increase in the living standards unprecedented in human existence, while rapid strides are now being seen in India, Vietnam and elsewhere. Now, notwithstanding the evident success of countries that have opened their borders to trade and investment, globalisation is under renewed pressure. Protectionism is on the rise yet again. A WTO report earlier this year showed that 1,583 trade restrictive measures have been put in place by G20 countries since 2008. There's also evidence that the pace of protectionism has recently accelerated. Between October 15 and May 16, G20 economies introduced new protectionist trade measures at the fastest pace seen since the global financial crisis, rolling out the equivalent of 5 a week. Now, we've been complicit in this rise in protectionism, though here it surfaces under a more subtle guise. A prominent example for us is the uptick of new anti-dumping investigations since the GFC and in the number of new anti-dumping measures imposed each year. So where does this drive for protectionism come from? There are a multitude of theories expressed in economic, social and political terms. The two that I find most compelling, though, are firstly the desire to support local jobs in the context of weak global demand, and second, growing discontent with rising within-country income disparity. I'll come back to that in a moment. But 7 years after the world economy emerged from the deep recession of the GFC, a return to broader-based, robust global economic growth remains elusive. In a slow-growth world and with elevated levels of uncertainty, it's proving far more difficult to break free from the constraints that we discovered with the GFC than I think almost any of us had anticipated. One response to this lack of global demand has been the pressure on governments to shield local industries or to attempt to give them a competitive advantage. Protectionist policies are seen as a way to achieve this in domestic markets, while accusations periodically surface that countries are resorting to currency devaluations as a tool to gain competitiveness in external markets. Now, as I mentioned, in the context of a weaker global economic growth outlook, a second driver of growing protectionist pressures is dissatisfaction with rising income disparities. While most emerging and market economies and advanced economies experienced significant growth in national income in the three decades preceding the GFC, the distribution of these gains has been very uneven within countries. This chart shows you the cumulative real income growth over the 23 years up until the most recent data that's available, which is 2011. And it also shows you how that has been distributed across the global income deciles. Most of the world is much poorer than the average Australian. So if you think of our population, most of us are going to be in that top income decile on the right-hand side of the chart. So right over around the 90 to 100 mark. You can see in the chart the impressive rise in real incomes enjoyed by most emerging market economies. That's the group in the middle. So that's your Chinas, your Indias, and so on. They dominate the middle part of the global income distribution. And the peak in the middle shows that average incomes at the global median more than doubled in real terms between 1988 and 2011. And note the solid increases at the bottom end. That's what I meant when I said we'd lifted a billion people out of abject poverty. You can actually see it. That's what we're talking about. Now, real incomes at the very top of the distribution have also continued to climb, consistent with globalisation and improvements in technology. But they have disproportionately benefited the owners of capital and workers with higher skills. What's evident in the chart is the lack of income growth around about the 90th percentile. This is a reflection of the lower and middle classes in the advanced economies having realised only limited gains in real incomes over the past three decades. Essentially, the story is that we've seen a decline in global income inequality, that is, between country inequality, as incomes for those in poorer countries have grown faster than those further up the distribution. But at the same time, for many countries, the within-country income inequality has risen and risen quite markedly. And so it's really striking. Have a look at the growth of income inequality in China now. The Gini coefficient in China is remarkable relative to Western economies. Rising protectionist pressures, I think, are in part a reaction to these growing income disparities. They're manifest in renewed calls to protect or support local jobs or industries. Now, we've not been immune from these global income trends, but it's undoubtedly the case that they have been much less marked here than what we've seen in the US or parts of Western Europe. Just out of order, I'll come back to that. If we look only at market income, that is income defined as the returns from labour and capital, inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient shows only a small gap between Australia and the United States over the last two decades. But importantly, Australia being more equal than the United States. But once you take account of our progressive tax and transfer systems, income inequality in Australia is clearly much lower than in the US. And I could do this for a range of Western countries and you'd see the same phenomenon. So Australia is really quite remarkable in that, we've had very little deterioration in our post-tax and transfer inequality over the last two decades. And secondly, we are quite standout relative to a lot of other countries we'd think of as our peers. So what might be going on? Well, if you look at real household income growth by decile, is that what you can see in this chart is that for Australia, every decile has seen an improvement in our income growth, and not a significant deterioration in terms of the growth between the deciles. If you look at the United States, by contrast, you see a much less even pattern of growth. And if you actually split this out and look at it by gender in the United States, what you see is that for the six lowest deciles, so the 60% at the bottom end of, so the bottom half plus a bit of the income distribution, for males, they've actually gone backwards over this period. And the fact that income has risen for households has been because it's risen for women and more women have gone into the workforce. Now, without the terms of trade boom on the back of the mining sector, Australia's experience may have looked more like the United States, but we'll never know that. What we do know is that income growth has been much more difficult to achieve following the GFC, and this has been exacerbated in our case by a decline in our terms of trade over the past 5 years. Now, that terms of trade phenomenon showing up, we're actually getting reasonable GDP growth, but because the price of our exports is falling relative to the price of our imports, our earning capacity, our purchasing power, is actually, in some years, has actually shrunk. Or put another way, living standards have declined. And I think it's this that's leading, in our case, to echoes of that protectionist sentiment that we're hearing overseas. We're hearing echoes of that sentiment that we've had in the past in Australia coming into our debates today. And that's showing up as a call in some quarters for return to direct industry support or more restrictive approaches to trade and investment. But we need to keep all this in context. While that pressure has started to arise here, we are very different to the situation in the United States and Western Europe, where globalisation has become a dirty word. This poses really significant challenges for the politics in these countries. Those who are arguing that advanced countries have failed to take seriously how the benefits of globalisation are distributed have developed a really quite compelling narrative in some of those countries and are gaining a support for a return to policies that are isolationist. Isolationist around trade, isolationist around investment, and as we've seen in Europe in particular, isolationist around migration. Or in other words, the exact opposite of the three things that the Treasurer was talking about when he was here last week. One of our challenges is to make sure we don't go down that road. And I think the question that needs to be asked of people who are putting these protectionist sentiments in Australia is, why would we imagine that the failed policies of the past, remember they were tried here and they failed here, why would we imagine that the failed policies of the past will somehow succeed in the future? While the gains from open trade and investment are clear, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that the protectionist policies which held back growth in previous decades, will miraculously now turn around and do the opposite. That is, there's no evidence at all that they can improve growth this time around. A retreat from globalisation would be to the detriment of all of the world's economies and dramatically slow growth in global living standards. And for countries like Australia, not part of any natural trading or bloc or grouping, such policies would likely consign us to a relative, if not absolute, decline in our living standards over time. So what should we do in response to these renewed calls for industry support and the imposition of protectionist measures? Well, the first response is really easy. Resist. Rather than retreat to the failed policies of the past, we need to strengthen our engagement with the global economy and particularly with the fast-growing nations of our region. We need to recognise that Australia will only succeed in the 21st century if we can tap into the enormous worldwide flows of technology, innovation, knowledge and commerce. The second response to the pressure on globalisation should be to better equip our workforce to participate in and prosper from the changes taking place in the global economy and the evolving nature of work. Education and training are absolutely critical domestic policy levers, both here and in other countries. We can pull these to build growth and support those who are more at risk from unemployment or underemployment during periods of structural change. The third response to the challenge should be to continue supporting those who, despite their best efforts, aren't able to rapidly reskill or find reasonable paying work and therefore require income assistance to sustain a reasonable standard of living. Rising inequality is not destiny. It is not a necessary consequence of the force of globalisation. I tend to that as evidence. It is in fact, rising inequality is in fact a choice made by individual countries. All governments have the policy apparatus at their disposal to build a more economically and socially equitable society that remains internationally competitive. Now, before the critics write me off as believing in big government, let me be clear. Our problem is not redistribution to the poorest. To the extent that we have a problem around welfare, it is actually this, the extent that it goes so high up the income distribution. So what I'm talking about here is income redistribution to the genuinely poor and needy. Now, the design of redistributive policies is even more important. Policies need to support work incentives, not create disincentives to work. And in fact, this morning I was talking at a conference in Melbourne about policy implementation, and I was talking in part there about the Australian investment approach to social welfare, which is very much designed to think about how do we actually reshape our policy mix to intervene at points in people's lives where we're going to have the maximum impact possible in terms of improving their ability to get out of the welfare trap. So I actually believe that the new focus on social investment is a profound structural reform and potentially, in fact, one of the most important that we've attempted to introduce in recent decades. So if you're not conscious of what this is about, I'd really encourage you to go and have a look at Minister Porter's speech to the National Press Club or the presentation I gave in Melbourne this morning. But all that's well and good. The one thing we know is that strong domestic policies on their own will not suffice. And we're here to talk about the G20, so that's what I'm going to do. Another vehicle for us is to use our voice in global fora, such as the G20, to push back against protectionism and participate in shaping the evolution of the rules-based global trade and investment system. That Asia has benefited so profoundly from globalisation, from the import of ideas from the Western world and the export of goods and services based on those ideas, owes much, if not all, to its participation in the liberal economic order. It's that regime of open markets, trade, investment flows, rules and effective institutions that has contributed to the environment in which Asian economies have been able to grow and flourish. The G20 in particular has played a critical role in ensuring that the liberal international rules-based environment has been sustained over the past decade and a half. Formed in the wake of the Asia financial crisis, the G20 played a crucial role in steering the world through the GFC, facilitating a high level of cooperation among the world's systemically important countries on macroeconomic and financial sector policies. Now, reflecting on that important role, some believe that therefore the conclusion to draw from that is the G20 is only works in a crisis. That is, outside of a crisis, the G20 has little to offer. There may be an element of truth that the G20 works best in a crisis, but it definitely undersells the G20's worth and achievements outside of a crisis. It's been important outside of crises for building and sustaining the policies and institutional frameworks that are important for achieving stronger growth and rising global prosperity in the years ahead. This year marks the midpoint of the five-year horizon of the Brisbane commitment to raise G20 collective GDP by 2% by the end of 2018, the 2 in 5 ambition that Joe Hockey so famously launched in 2014. Analysis from the international organisations suggests the G20 has so far achieved about half of this growth ambition, with fully implemented policy commitments made since the Brisbane summit expected to contribute an additional 1% to collective G20 GDP. Remember, though, what's happened during that same period is growth in the absence of that effort has actually declined. So growth rates have slowed, and to the extent that they haven't slowed more, it's because of the effort that the G20 did. Now, some would argue, and the Australian newspaper has carried this story, that the G20's failure to have delivered the full 2% growth ambition halfway through the period threatens to undermine the G20's credibility. I couldn't disagree more. Before rushing to judgment, we need to consider the counterfactual. Where would we be today if Australia hadn't put the collective 2 in 5 growth target on the table in Brisbane 2 years ago? I think I answered that question a moment ago. Given the more than 1,300 structural reform commitments that have been made since Brisbane, I find it hard to believe that global growth could have been in a better place without the growth target. And in fact, I'm convinced that it would have been in a far in a far worse place. Having said that, more ambitious structural reform efforts and additional policies to support growth and innovation are clearly necessary if we're going to avoid a new normal of what Christine Lagarde refers to as mediocre global growth. This is as much the case for Australia as it is for any other G20 economy. In addition to promoting stronger growth, the G20 is also addressing concerns about global inequality, that is both the within country and the between country inequalities that I was talking about before. Promoting open trade and investment is one way that G20 is acting to reduce between country income inequality. And while G20 members have been far from pure when it comes to protection, my judgment is that the collective responsibility that they've exercised when they've sat around that G20 leaders table has helped restrain the tendencies beyond what they would otherwise have delivered. Making sure our growth strategies support development and inclusive growth is another key way to address within-country inequality, and this has been a consistent theme of leaders at recent summits. Perhaps the most visible G20 commitments aiming at addressing inequality, though, are those related to tax avoidance and anti-corruption. The G20 has led the global crackdown on corporate tax base erosion and profit shifting, or the beautifully known BEPS, and the use of offshore financial accounts and entities in secrecy jurisdictions to avoid tax. G20 has made meaningful commitments to address inequality through its work to reduce the cost of remittances. Almost 80% of global remittances flow from G20 countries to other parts of the world. So to the extent that the work that we can do is reduce the cost of remittances, we actually are ensuring more of the money that people are earning in G20 countries that they want to remit to their home country is actually getting home. And that's an area where we're playing a key role, given the importance of remittances for our neighbours in the Pacific and Southeast Asia. I think the other thing I'd say about the G20 is that its other great strength is its convening power. When issues of global economic significance arise, there are great advantages of being able to develop a response under the auspices of the G20. Doing so signals that the issue is one that the international community takes seriously, which means that other institutions, whether it's the IMF or the International Accounting Standards Board or securities regulators or financial regulators or whomever, they have to take that seriously. And that is both for public institutions and private institutions. It's been really quite remarkable how things that have been stuck in particular bodies, global bodies, have been able to be freed up simply by getting the issue onto the G20 leaders' agenda. It is remarkable how quickly people respond when they know that they're going to be expected to stand up in front of a bunch of leaders and explain. Now, examples of the benefits of that convening power are the work I mentioned on global tax evasion and remittances. But another example, which I suspect you probably know far less about, but which is an important global economic and health issue, is the rising threat of antimicrobial resistance, where the G20 has basically said, we've got a market failure arising from limited incentives to discover new antibiotics in time to prevent future pandemics. And what is it that we, the G20, can do here to try and change some of those incentives? So let me conclude. Calls for industry protection and retreat from open trade investment are not new, but they are again gaining force. After starting our journey as a federation with a global outlook, our retreat into protectionist policies after the First World War levied a heavy toll on the competitiveness of the Australian economy and on our national living standards. It was not until the 1980s that we systematically focused again on improving our international competitiveness. Since then, Australia has arguably been one of the greatest beneficiaries of globalisation. The significant increase in our living standards over the past three decades is testament to the reforms of the 1980s and 1990s that transformed Australia into an open and flexible economy. It's important that we build on these gains, avoiding calls for return to the failed industry support and protectionist policies of the past, and instead focus on equipping the current and future workforce to capitalise on the opportunities that globalisation presents, and using our progressive tax and transfer system to ensure that nobody is left behind. But as a small open economy, we live and die by the success of the rules-based international economic order. But that order needs legitimacy and buy-in from all major players. And the creation of the G20 after the Asia crisis was recognition of this in the face of a changing world. Almost two decades on, if the G20 didn't exist, I doubt we could create it. And more importantly, if we weren't a member, I know we would not be invited to join. So our national interest imperative is clear. Work to make the G20 a success, push the agenda by being constructive, and use the G20 experience to reflect back into our domestic arena the importance of the key macroeconomic and structural policies focused on openness, innovation, competitiveness to sustain our living standards. And I'd just like to finish up by congratulating the Institute for the role it's played over the last 4 years in helping us do that. It's been a major contribution. Everybody involved is to be absolutely congratulated. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Martin, for making a very interesting speech on globalisation and Australia and the G20. And I think you said that the full speech will be available on the PM&C website. We'll make it available on the Institute's website as well. You've opened up so many interesting issues, and we've got about 20 minutes or so for questions. Let me kick it off with a couple, if I may. First of all, on the first part of your speech, which was about Australia, and you talked about the fabled reform period in the 80s and 90s. And often nowadays, a contrast is drawn between the policy debate, the policy reform, the political system in those days, and the last decade or so when we've seen so much political churn in Australia. Martin, what are the reasons that we should be optimistic about the likelihood of our political class getting its mojo back together and implementing the kinds of economic reforms that you've spoken of that Australia needs to prosper, rather than succumbing to the siren songs of protectionism and isolationism that you mentioned we're seeing in other comparable countries? Why should we feel positive about this?
Michael, I don't know whether people saw it, but Paul Kelly had a great piece in The Australian 2 weekends ago, talking about the launch, Peter Costello's launch of William Coleman's new book. And he was drawing out this this question really quite starkly. Should we be pessimistic about our ability to basically reinvigorate the policy debate? And And William, I haven't yet had a chance to read the book, but my sense from Paul's article is William wasn't saying that one should be pessimistic, but he was saying it's going to be a lot harder than simply hoping we'll get back there. Whereas Paul was, I think, at the more optimistic end in saying that inevitably the pressures that will emerge in the economy will force the political class to embrace change. Now, that implies that the political class hasn't done anything in the interim. And that's clearly not true. I mean, you can look around in a wide range of areas and see over the last 15 years initiatives that are reforms. But they're a different type of reform. Think about NDIS. Now, this is a reform where we're taking a group of people who are otherwise, in many cases, marginalised by society. We're giving them the opportunity to have the services and supports that they need, and we're actually doing something which we haven't done elsewhere. We're actually making it consumer-directed. So we're starting this process, albeit slowly, of injecting competition into human services areas. Not the sorts of things that lots of economists who commentate in the press think of as big and sexy. It's not like somehow I've just returned the budget to surplus, but these are reforms. As I said when I was talking about the investment approach to welfare, this could turn out to be one of the most profound reforms that we will have undertaken in a lot of decades. It'll take a long time for us to see whether that's the case. The things that we've tried to do and are trying to do in the Indigenous space, big reforms. I think the story when we talk about the lack of reform, people really mean it's the fiscal drift, it's the inability to, in a sense, get in and make big change economic policy sphere. And I'm actually quite confident that we will be able to do this, albeit we'll have to do it very differently. That is, the 1980s, 1990s model was a creature of its own history. As I said in the speech, when we started that reform process in the 80s, we had a decade bookended by two recessions, a period where everybody in Australia, and as Keating used to talk about, the galah and the pet shop, was able to talk about structural reform. Why? Because they'd all experienced declining relative living standards and they all knew we were on the road nowhere. Think about where we are today. We've had 25 years of under economic growth. Notwithstanding the stories you might hear that those Gini coefficients showed, we haven't had a significant deterioration in unemployment. In inequality. We missed the almost certain recession that we would have had with the Asian financial crisis. We missed it, albeit very, very luckily, with the tech wreck, and we missed it with the GFC. And I think that's actually led the public to have a different view about the urgency of reform. So people like us in this room see an urgency for reform and see opportunities slipping away, but the public have not yet been seized with that. And I think it'll be when we can get the public seized with that, that to actually lead from the front in that space rather than where they've been on the reform agenda.
Let me ask you one other question and then let me go to the audience. The second part of your speech was about the world and about globalisation and the G20. The issue that every galah in every pet shop has a view on these days is probably China. Mm-hmm. And can I ask you about how Australia should comport itself in relation to China? China is a huge country. It has had magnificent success in lifting, I think, 700 million odd people out of poverty. Mm-hmm. It's a huge market that presents enormous opportunities for us, but it's also a very different society from ours. It's not a democracy. It's a country whose foreign policy is changing. It's running a very assertive policy in the waters around its coasts. And in the past couple of months, you've seen some of the friction between Australia and China breaking into the news with this big debate on alleged Chinese attempts to influence Australian policy. So let me ask you a simple question. How should Australians think about China? What is the recipe for success in dealing with such an enormous country that presents different challenges and different opportunities, great economic challenges, but real foreign policy and security challenges?
Yes, it was very good interjection. I'm actually going to squib the question in part because I think the issue is China doesn't necessarily know what it wants either. That for me means that we need to be really clear about our values, about our openness. People frame it in terms of we have to choose. I think that's a nonsense way of thinking about it. I think we've got to be very clear about what's our national interest and articulate that consistently and clearly. The one thing that that I know from my experience with China over almost two decades now is Chinese fully understand if you are clear with them. And in fact, it's exactly the same thing Australians don't like, is people saying one thing to them in private and one thing to them, a separate thing in public. And we have been absolutely consistent in our approach in being very clear about the importance of the economic opportunities for China in engaging with us and for us in engaging with China, but at the same time being very clear about where our interests are when it comes to national security, foreign policy, and so on. And I think we have to continue to do that. We have to be able to have a sufficiently open and robust relationship with them that we can speak very candidly, and I think we have that. And you would expect me to say this, but I actually think they genuinely do respect that. Having sat in meetings with leaders, what they absolutely respect is our willingness to be frank and candid. And that, I think, is a key part of the issue for us. We just have to recognise that we will not agree on every issue and start off our engagement on that presumption. We have great opportunities to do things together. In lots of areas we have shared interests, but not in all. And in those areas where we don't have shared interests, we're going to be quite clear. And I think that's absolutely critical if we want to nurture that relationship.
Excellent. Thank you. In the absence of hands shooting up, I see I'll call on this gentleman first, and then I'll go to Hannah Wirth on the other side. Yes. If you could just wait for the microphone. Tell us your affiliation if you have one at the beginning, and limit yourself to a short question if you would.
Absolutely. Thank you. Martin Hoffman, Secretary in New South Wales Department of Finance and Services. Martin, good to see you. Question on the Gini chart there. Mm-hmm. What was striking was, yes, Australia improved a lot more than the US when you moved post-tax and transfers, mm-hmm. And our line was pretty flat over the last 20 years, but so was the United States line.
Mm-hmm.
The gap really didn't change much. It's 4 or 5 points.
Yeah,
that's sort of different to the narrative we hear about the rapidly increasing inequality in the US driving Trump, etc. Can you just explain that point?
Yeah, I actually think that shows the last 20 years. The real gap opens up in the US back in the basically from the late 80s, early 90s onwards. Now, I don't know, I haven't looked at the Gini coefficient, but that's where I was talking about the fact that real average hourly wages for the six lowest deciles for males have fallen relative to where they were 30-odd years ago. And it does seem to me that what you're seeing in the US is a combination of factors. You've seen the first wave of globalisation take out a lot of the blue-collar males. And so that's pre-1995. That data starts in 95. And if you think about it, the guys working in the factories, they had a sense of who they were and who these were. And that was eroded. Then you saw the phenomenon that was reflected in that book, Bowling Alone, where it was the erosion of community organisations, community spirit, and a fragmentation. And then since then, you've seen a number of other phenomena that have emerged. And in fact, there's a very interesting article in recent edition of Mother Jones, which is a left-leaning American magazine, where they an American sociologist, he says, I don't understand the phenomenon of the Tea Party and the support for Trump. Let me go to Louisiana and hang out with a whole pile of people who are clearly supportive. And you know, I don't know whether this is right or not, but there's a lot about in this article that I find plausible, which is that people understood that they were in a queue and they might not move very quickly up the income distribution, but the opportunity was there. And they've seen people, in a sense, queue jump. And that's been the latest part of this. And whether those things together add up to the phenomenon that we're seeing in the United States, it may or may not be the case. I mean, other people have to come to that conclusion with the benefit of history, benefit of experience. But it is sort of striking that when you look there or where you look in Europe and the sort of erosion of the integrity of borders, and I don't mean national borders, I mean sort of the community border, that you're seeing these sorts of phenomena arise. I don't know the answers, Martin. I just think there's a lot more water that's going to have to flow under the bridge before we really understand what's driving this Western economies at the moment. But, you know, if you look around and you see, you know, if you feel like you've missed out and you open the papers and you see that there are scandals involving business, there's the Panama Papers and the like, you can understand why for some people that might erode trust in the system, and then they might look for people who can promise another way forward. But in the midst of all big changes, you never really understand what's going on. So I think this is one for the historians to be able to write about and explain it with the benefit.
I'm tempted to ask you for an opinion on Donald Trump, but we like you too much at the Institute to try to get you into trouble like that, Martin. So I'll call instead on Hannah Wirth.
Thanks, Martin, for a great speech. I'm Hannah Wirth with the Institute. I wonder if you could comment a bit more about the communication challenges around the benefits of globalization. I think you rightly pointed out at Hangzhou there was some really important discussions about inequality, but the communique was, I think, more than 7,000 words, and very few people, except people like me who are paid to read it, would have done so.
I thought you read it, Hannah, because you found it riveting. Look, I actually think I think the issue of communication across the entire policy agenda, not just around inequality, is a real challenge. It's really ironic, isn't it, that we've had this explosion of media channels, social media, various other things, and yet, if anything, it's narrowing people's information sources rather than expanding them. I mean, the fact is that if I want, I can go online and I can set up so that every day I get my news, but the news I get is actually the same news that my friends are reading. So I can then go and talk to them about what I've read and reinforce the opinions that they've got, and they can tell me what they've read, reinforce my opinions. Well, that's not how it used to be. I mean, our newspapers used to essentially be centrist. They'd reflect a wide range of views, but they'd be pretty centrist. And Australia was quite unusual in a sense vis-a-vis, say, the UK, where the red masks, you know, phenomenon, that is, newspapers, you knew they took very marked political positions. And by that, I don't mean necessarily mean party political, but you'd know where they'd stand on the spectrum of issues. I think we're struggling. Whereas the we, in this case, is the policy community, is struggling to work out how to create that compelling narrative and how to get it into the hands of the public. You know, in the 80s, I remember, as the time of Alan Wood and Steve Burrell and Michael Stutchbury all being journalists, Ross Gittins and Laura Tingle just starting out, and it, you know, every paper you picked up had stories, in-depth stories about the economic situation confronting Australia. And foreigners would come here and say, oh, my God, you must have the most amazing media. But I actually think it was context-driven. You know, there was that two recessions in a decade and a lost decade and this sense that we were in big trouble. And at the moment, you don't have that.
Steve Grenville at the back.
I want to ask about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But two different aspects of it. One is the economics. If it doesn't go ahead, which seems reasonably likely now, if it doesn't go ahead, is that any great loss from the point of view of economics and putting in place the rules? And secondly, is it any great loss that this group of countries that we're going to get together and, in a sense, confront is maybe too strong a word, but look very strongly at China? Is that security aspect of the TPP?
Yes. No, so look, the Obama administration has made very clear to all of the other TPP parties that it is going to push forward for ratification. Whether or not they have the numbers to do so will be become evident after the election, so after the 8th of November. But they have assured all TPP parties that they will be doing everything possible to try and get TPP through before the president leaves office. Will the failure of TPP be a problem on the economic side or on the... I wouldn't call it security, I'd call it geostrategic in a sense, Steve. Undoubtedly it will, because if we can't get TPP up, it basically says that we should aim for lower quality trade agreements. And I find it hard to believe, you know, I'm a multilateralist, as you know, but if we're going to have plurilateral agreements, then I want them to be as good as they can be, recognising the political constraints. And if we fail to get TPP through, I think one of those messages is we should have less ambition. And I think that's bad for us from an economic perspective. I think the other thing, though, is TPP is actually a signal of US geostrategic intent. And if that fails to be delivered... then what message should countries in the region take from that? And I'll leave that as a question for people to ponder.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are more people who want to ask questions, but our time has run out. Let me just say that there are those of us at the Institute are great admirers of Martin, so we were very pleased indeed to see him brought back into government and indeed appointed to head the Australian Public Service. And I think we've seen in his speech and the way he's taking questions tonight that admiration is deserved. I want to thank you, Martin, for coming, for taking questions on a very broad range of issues. I think it was a great note to end the work of the G20 Studies Centre on. We learned a lot, including that PM&C has a subscription to Mother Jones. So perhaps we'll hear more about that in estimates, or perhaps that's your own sub, is it?
No, it's not the department's, nor is it mine. It was drawn to my attention by someone else.
So thank you, Martin Parkinson, very much for coming and giving what I hope is the first of many speeches to the Institute as Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Martin. Thank you very much.